Today's date is December 14, 1973. I'll be interviewing Tony Gallagher. My name is Jane Holt. Tony, the first thing I'd like to ask you is what service were you in? What branch?
The Navy.
The Navy? What year did you join?
Well, I was on active duty starting in 69, but I was at the academy from 65 on.
Which academy?
The Naval Academy, Annapolis.
Annapolis?
Mm-hmm.
What made you go into the academy?
Ooh, I have a family history. My father was in the Navy for 30 years and got out as a captain. And I didn't have anything else that I was really into at the end of high school. Naval career looked like a pretty good thing. And so I went to the academy, which seemed to me to be the way to do it if you wanted to be a naval officer.
Right. So when you went on active in 69, were you an officer?
Yes. Like when you graduate from the Naval Academy, you're an ensign in the Navy. Or you can be in the Marine Corps also, but I was in the Navy.
What pay rate is that? E what?
It's 01.
01?
Yeah.
Okay. So from Annapolis, where did you go when you went on active?
Well,
police station.
I was actually active at the academy, but I'm using active to mean really in the Navy.
Right.
They considered me active while I was at the academy. But after there, I had a couple months leave, and then I came out to San Diego for about 2 months of schools.
Which schools?
Electronics Materiel Officer School, which is what I was aboard the ship, and firefighting, and oh, I don't remember. There were a couple other little one-day, this is the Navy schools, I don't remember what they were.
Did you have to go through any, what am I trying to think of? Oh, captive schools, SEER schools.
No,
SEER schools, okay. What training did you have in San Diego specifically? For the layman, can you kind of tell them what it entailed?
Sure. Well, my job, I was not an electronics expert. I was a math major at school, but basically I was just a manager. I had about 12 guys under me, and we were responsible for making sure that all the communications equipment and all the electronic countermeasures equipment and all the radar on the ship worked and stayed working, and so we had to maintain it. And the school just basically taught me what types of electronics gear was aboard the ship and what sort of problems to expect and how to go about getting them fixed if the men on board the ship couldn't do it, what messages to write to who and where to get parts and things like that. And a little bit thrown in on management techniques, but very informally. And they tried to give us a basic understanding of how some of the equipment worked a little bit. I mean, just really very broad. I had a year of, I guess they would call it, it was electricity, electronics at school, a science class, so I knew pretty much what was going on, but some of the guys just had no idea, so they had to give them a basic outline of, you know, this is a receiver, this is a transmitter.
What type of ship were you training for? What type of ship
well,
did you go on?
You could be, I could have, the class would have enabled me to go to most ships, but they geared the class to destroyer, which is what I went to, the types of equipment that are on a destroyer.
Now after San Diego, you were stationed there for 2 months. Where did you go next?
To Yokosuka, Japan, where my ship was home ported, and I met the ship there.
How long was it stationed there before you went to another place?
Well, we were in and out of Yokosuka. Every couple of months we get back there. A couple of weeks or so. Well, we could pick up supplies anywhere, but since that was our home port, some people had wives there and stuff like that, so they made a special effort to get our ship back to that particular port more.
Can you spell it for me?
Yokosuka.
Yokosuka. Or close.
Y-O-K-U-S-A?
Y-O-K-U-S-A?
It's Yokosuka. Y-O-K-O-S-U-K-A.
I've been having problems with some of these Oriental.
Y-O-K-O-S-U-K-A, that's right.
Okay, good. So how long were you at Yokosuka before you went?
We did a lot of things besides go offshore.
Let me ask you first, what date was it when you got to Japan? Or
approximately, it was the first week in August, in October.
Of what year?
Of 1969. I don't remember exactly when.
That's okay, just a month and a year to give some kind of chronological order.
We went down to the gun line and shot some, and we,
What's a gun line?
Oh, I'm sorry. The gun line is just that. You get a bunch of ships a few thousand yards off the shore of Vietnam, and you train your guns and you shoot.
North Vietnam? South Vietnam?
Both. We were down in South.
Okay.
There are two different areas, Yankee Station and whatever the hell the other one was. We were down at the other one in South, and we were shooting down around the Mekong Delta area. But there were people up north too. It was a lot more hazardous up north, and they did different kinds of things because they had guns that could shoot back at you up there. And so lots of times they had different sorts of missions. You just didn't sit a couple miles off and shoot. You had to run in and shoot and then run back out again while they were shooting at you. We also, part of our job was to chase carriers around, and carriers would fly strikes in.
U.S. carriers?
Yes, United States aircraft carriers. And you'd have two destroyers behind each one, and they'd fly missions into Vietnam, and then in case anybody got hit and had to bail out on the way back, we'd be there to pick them up. Or, so, you know, something happened on the ship where one of the planes went over the side or something. There'd be somebody there to protect them and to try to pick them up out of the water.
So what ship were you on? What was it called?
I was on the George K. McKenzie.
George K. McKenzie. Never heard of that one.
It's just an old destroyer.
Most of them are pretty old.
I think the McKenzie's in mothballs now. They phased most of those out.
Well, you were a junior officer, right?
Yes.
Tack that name on you. How did your men under you feel about you? How did you feel that they felt about you?
It's a difficult question to answer. Part of the men that were under me were just administratively under me. I had 12 guys that I worked with very closely. It varied from 9 to 12. And then I had another 25 that worked in the... There was another officer who was supposedly under me, but he just did his own work, and it was just an administrative thing, and I made decisions on a few things, but really not much. And I got along with all of them pretty well, because, I got along better than most officers do in some instances, because I was starting to question the Navy and the military and all this sort of stuff around that time, and I wasn't a very hard-line individual.
How were you questioning it? What were you thinking?
Well,
what made you start thinking, questioning?
The academy itself, partially, because they were so pro-military, so unbelievably pro-military, they wouldn't even think of another side, and it bothered me to have people that narrow-minded. And also, I took a history of sea power there last year, and all we ever talked about was how wonderful it was that these people were tremendously efficient at killing other people, and that started to prey on my mind a little bit too. And just, I got into studying different wars and why they came about and this sort of thing. And, when I went to the Navy, when I went to my ship, I was resigned to the fact that it was necessary, but I didn't like it at all. And eventually my feelings evolved to where I left the military entirely, became a conscientious objector. But it took me a couple of years to get all the way there.
Had you completed your active duty though?
When I got out? No, I got out 3 years early.
You got out 3 years early? How did you go about doing that?
It wasn't easy. Nobody knew how to do it at the time. Yeah, I just, there's an application form they have in case somebody who's in the military wants to get out that way, and you fill out, you write your feelings down, why you want to get out, and then you have to have, you're interviewed by a chaplain and the executive, or an officer, O2 or above, and the captain, and a psychiatrist. And all these people write recommendations and attach them to your application, and that goes back to Washington. And somewhere in the Pentagon, somebody looks at that sort of stuff and decides whether you get out or not. And they wrote back to me and said that I couldn't get out. They didn't believe me. So I went to civilian court and got a lawyer and sued the Navy and got out that way. And it took about a year to get out after I'd filed.
What kind of discharge did you get?
I got an honorable discharge.
Did you really? For other people that might be in this situation, could you give a kind of a step-by-step process from obtaining a lawyer in a civilian court situation?
Well, I got the lawyer before. I was worried, since I was Naval Academy, I had a feeling that they weren't going to look on my application too favorably. So I got a lawyer. Well, I did a lot of reading on it to find out what the court cases were and what the Supreme Court had to say about who could get out and who couldn't. And then I got a lawyer to read my application to see if it fit the letter of the law. And I also had him come with me when the officer interviewed me, the O2 interview. It's a pretty important interview. They put a lot of weight on that, and I wanted to make sure. I'd heard of a lot of people who had very, very hostile officers interviewing them, who sent in erroneous reports saying that the guy shouldn't get out. So I wanted the lawyer there with me. In case I got turned down, he'd be able to continue with my case. And as I did, I just went back to him and said, now what do we do? And he filed a writ of habeas corpus, I believe, in San Diego, saying that the government had no grounds for turning down my application, that I'd followed all the correct procedures and had a valid application, and the government had no grounds for turning me down. And we ran into complications because the Navy wanted to get rid of me at the time. They sent me to Japan again while my case was being, after I'd been turned down, they gave me orders to go to Japan because when they found out that I was suing here in San Diego to get out. And once I'd been transferred to Japan, or once I'd been officially transferred to Japan, I wasn't under the jurisdiction of the San Diego court anymore, and I was under the jurisdiction of Washington, because Washington has command of everybody that's overseas. So I was debating not following orders and not going, but if you do that, then they stop proceedings on your conscientious objection until they court-martial you. So I figured that I'd just go and not do anything and then get things going. Fortunately, my lawyer knew another lawyer in Washington and mailed the case back to him, and he presented it in Washington. And the Navy, the day that it was going to be heard, the Navy came in and said they changed their minds, they were going to let me out, and they didn't press it. And so we never even went to court. We were in court, but there was never a decision. The Navy just let me go.
Did you have to go to Washington to
No, I didn't. That was a question that was raised, was whether the lawyer I had in Washington was a big publicity man. He'd gotten a couple other guys out back there by calling newspapers in and getting a lot of, Navy really didn't like him at all, getting a lot of publicity about this sort of thing. And he was thinking of subpoenaing me to appear. And then the question would arise whether the Navy had to fly me back or not. Because I used up all my leave before I went to Japan, trying to get things settled before I had to go, so I didn't have any leave. And if they disappeared me, we don't know whether I'd have gone back or not. But he was so sure we were going to win, he decided not to push it.
He was right.
Well, they didn't have a case.
Well, when you were on ship, when you went from Japan to Vietnam, you were on a ship, but when you came back to Japan, you were stationed on a base. You didn't have to stay on your ship,
you
right?
Well, you had to be on the ship every day while you were there, but you could sleep off it if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But you were still attached. You didn't have any government housing provided or anything like that, unless you were married. If you were married and your wife was there, then you'd have housing.
Right.
But if not...
Married?
No. If not, it was possible to get an apartment or something in town. But most guys just lived on the ship.
Okay, so you were very familiar with ship life then, basically.
Oh, yeah.
No doubt about it.
I lived in Aden. I was there all the time. and I was busy all the time. So, you know, when I was in port, I was on the ship most of the time anyway, because if we'd been out at sea for 30 or 40 days, half the stuff had broken when we got to port, and then we had to run around and get the Japanese shops to fix it.
How many hours were you on duty? Or should I ask, how many off-duty hours did you have?
It depended on what your ship, what your situation was. There was no specified time. It depended on what your superior officer had to say and how your particular situation was. Everyone had to stand watch every third or fourth day, depending on how many officers there were aboard. You had to stay on the ship all day that day and all night, and you had to stand watches on the quarter deck, which is how you get on the ship, from land to the ship, to make sure that no subversive got on or anything like that, just to make sure that the ship was run efficiently and orderly. So every fourth day or every third day, depending, you had to be there all the time. And then normal working hours were from 7:45 to 5:00. But if things were going poorly, you'd have to keep people aboard. You'd have to just work and work through the night or however long it took.
Well, when you first got there, were you having, you were questioning the Navy at that time?
I wasn't questioning the Navy. I mean, I was questioning the concept of war, I guess. But I was pretty much of the opinion that, much as I detested the emphasis that was put on it and all this sort of thing, I really couldn't see any alternative. I thought it was necessary to protect national interests and humanitarian concerns, and I just thought that the good guys had better have a military, and so I was going to be one of the good guys.
Did you feel that you were helping the Vietnamese by being there?
Now, that, I hadn't done much reading on Vietnam up until then. It had just been basically a case of, we were stopping the communists, but I wasn't entirely buying that program, and I did start to do some reading, so that by the time we got down there, I was really ambivalent in my feelings toward the thing. I really, I was siding towards, as a matter of fact, by the time we got down there, we were actually doing the shooting, I was anti-Vietnam, I was against the war, but I still thought that there were selective wars where I would participate. You know, we still needed the military, it was just that it was being applied in the wrong directions. And so I was of the opinion that if you're going to have a military, people are going to have to obey, because it won't function otherwise. And down there, I was part of the military, and it was going on, and the civilian people were deciding where we were going to be fighting and where we weren't, and so I was obligated to continue and carry out the duties down there.
What do you mean civilian people were deciding?
The commander-in-chief is a civilian. The president.
The president, true. Well, on board ship, how was the general feeling? Well, how many men were on board ship?
About 350, somewhere around there.
Really,
350. Of which maybe 17 were officers, 17 or 18.
Made a rough, small minority. Were there any racial minorities that were officers? Were they all Anglo?
No. No, we were all Caucasian.
How many minorities were there on the ship?
Quite a few, but I don't know exactly how many. I would say in the neighborhood of 50, but
50
men altogether of all various ranks and rates. I didn't have any in my special category. There were no black electronics technicians.
What about besides blacks, Chicanos, Orientals?
Well, there are the ever-present Filipinos who
they were on board,
who were in the wardroom. They cooked the officers' meals and served the meals and cleaned the dishes and straightened the staterooms and just menial tasks like that.
Servant.
Yeah, they're basically butlers, I guess, or something of that nature. Servants, at any rate. And there were 6 or 8 those, I suppose. And a few Chicanos, but I could, you know, I can remember four or five, but I just don't have any idea how many there were on the ship.
Did you ever have any problems with any unrest with minorities?
We didn't have any on our ship. There was a feeling of black solidarity, I would say, but it never erupted to the point where there was any real conflict. My best friend was the deck officer who had charge of almost all of the blacks, and he...
Why would he have charge of almost all the blacks?
Because that's all the blacks are in the deck force, almost. Some of them, see, they simply haven't got the training for other... for the more complicated things. It's racism of a sort, you know. I mean, the Navy is getting away from it, I suppose, but the electronics technicians, there are almost no black electronic technicians, or even radar men or communications men, or some in the weapons department, they had some that would work on the guns. But most of them are just guys who have been drafted and gone in, and they join the deck force, and they...
What does the deck force do?
You maintain the surface areas of the ship, clean things, keep the ropes in order. You're in charge of when the ship docks, they have to get it tied up correctly, and when you refuel at sea, they're mostly in charge of the refueling process. And the ship's boat, if anyone goes overboard or anything, they have the boat. And if you take the boat to another ship or anything, they're in charge of the boat and its maintenance and repair. And they, when you drive the ship around, they stand watches. There's the bosun's mate of the watch. And he's in charge of the enlisted personnel who are on the bridge while the ship is going around. And they serve as lookouts and as helmsmen and things like that. But, as I said, my friend was in charge of the division that had almost all of the blacks, and he was a good officer. He was strict, but he was really fair and equal, and he doesn't have any prejudice in him. And even, an officer can't control it, though. It's the petty officers that really control the racism, if it's going to be there. And he tried to find out what was there and what wasn't there, and... I don't think it was bad on our ship. I never had any real contact with it. Ted never had any problems that I know of. But I know, you know, the blacks had a feeling of brotherhood. They greet themselves and give the power shake and stuff like that.
Did you have any friends that were black on board ship?
No, I didn't. None of the officers were, and you just don't make friends with enlisted men. It's not done.
Let's switch over to drugs, so you know, minorities. Did you have any problems on board ship with drugs? And when I say drugs, I mean marijuana, opium, heroin,
we had,
acid, you know, etc.
Drugs were there. I know that, because I had them.
You smoked?
Yeah. It was before, when we were there, it was just before they made the big crackdown on drugs. And I know that five of the officers aboard smoked, which would have destroyed the ship if that had come out. God, if one of us had gotten caught, the captain would have lost his command for sure. We had it aboard from time to time. I never smoked aboard. I don't think anyone did.
Any of the officers?
Any of the officers did, because... there was just too much to do, and you had to stand watches and be responsible, and it just wouldn't have done. It wasn't safe. The same thing with alcohol. I know some guys had it aboard, but I didn't ever see anybody really drinking. The situation was different with enlisted men, but I was very careful not to find out about it. I didn't want to know, I'm sure, that they were doing it. You know,
never
there was
smoked with enlisted men?
Oh, heavens no. My God, that would have been so dangerous. There was one officer aboard who did, but he was crazy.
Why?
Because the chances of an enlisted guy getting busted are a lot greater. Because there are more of them, it's more prevalent, and the officers are pretty much immune. When I was there, I mean, we could do crazy things and get away with it, because nobody was looking for it from us, but they were looking at it, for it from them. And if one of them got busted, it would be the easiest thing in the world for him to make a deal saying, you know, take it easy on me, and I know lots of officers. And it was just, it would have been absolutely foolish. You'd been putting your life on the line.
So you just smoked with other officers?
Right, that was it. And I think our ship was the exception as far as officers go. I don't think most ships had that many officers that were smoking. There was some speed, just one, as a matter of fact, just one of the officers. I know guys who had dropped acid. Nobody did while we were aboard the overseas, because you don't know how long the effects are going to be there. You know, and if you're going to be operating, you just don't want to fool around with something like that. So nobody did while we were over there that I know of. And I'm sure I would have known. And some guys had taken a little speed now and again. And occasionally I know one guy would take some speed. But again, this was all, as far as I know, it was all when we hit port and we were going to be off the ship for 30 or 40 days. Nobody fooled around with any drugs while we were at sea, as far as I know. And because I was into it, I just didn't want to know what the enlisted guys were doing. I knew, I mean, from guys that talk about it, you know, and they'd make insinuations around me, because I think they had a feeling that I probably knew what was going on, and I would just pretend I didn't hear. I didn't want to be in a position to put a finger on anyone, and I just didn't want to know. So
it kept you out of trouble.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, when did you first come in contact with drugs? Did you do it in the States, or were you?
My first contact was overseas. Some of my friends on the ship had been smoking in college, and we hit a port somewhere, and it was the easiest thing in the world to pick up marijuana overseas.
True.
And we smoked a couple times here.
Well,
and
how did they approach you, and how did you react?
Well, it was one guy, basically, that I was in the same room with, and we got to be good friends and going out and drinking, and he just talked about his college experiences, and I guess he just got to be comfortable with me and mentioned that he had and intended to, and I guess I probably said, well, I might like to try it sometime or something of that nature.
Did you try anything else besides marijuana?
No, not while I was... while I was overseas. No.
But when you came back?
When I came back, I fooled around a little bit.
Yeah, so we'll stick with overseas. How did they crack down on the drugs? You know, how did they work on the enlisted men?
Well, they had drug education programs, but again, when I was there, this was new for the Navy. It was just coming in. And periodically officers were supposed to lecture enlisted men on various subjects anyway, just all
like
sorts of things. Hygiene, morale, conduct in foreign ports, and then some lectures on the equipment or the jobs you were doing and things like that. You conducted training, had a petty officer give a lecture or something like that. One of the lectures that we were scheduled to give was on drugs. And so you would give a lecture explaining, well, it wasn't really, you were supposed to tell them how bad they were and how to stay with it, away with it and all that sort of thing. And I basically made guys aware of what was around and what could happen to you on different drugs. And basically, if you get caught when you're in the Navy, no matter what you're doing, you're in real deep trouble.
What would happen?
Well, you'd be immediately out of the Navy.
With what kind of a discharge?
It would depend on your record. And
say someone that had a perfect record up until that time.
They might even just give you an administrative discharge. Of course, they might not. They might throw him in a brig, too. It depends on who's pushing it, too.
They could put them in the brig. For how long a period?
I really don't know. I'm not that up. I got into military law a little bit, but not that much. And later on, they'd have drug education people come aboard from shore-based places, and they'd get a little tab, a little portion of a brick and burn it in the wardroom so you knew what it smelled like, and the electron just tell you what it was and how to find it. And then I don't really, on our ship we never had any crackdowns or searches or anything like that, but I'm sure other ships did a lot. As I said, I was there a little bit before it really broke and got heavy. They started inspecting you coming back all the time. And they'd send out teams to the ship, and the teams would run through the ship and try to find drugs while you were at sea. I believe they put any dogs on the ships at sea, but I don't know about that. They'd just come in with a helicopter and land a team, and they'd go through the ship.
But they rarely found anything on board your ship?
Well, a team never came aboard my ship. Died if they had. I had some stuff in my stateroom.
How much did you usually carry?
Oh, we just usually had a couple of ounces. I take that back. We had on to a pound at one stage. And another officer that I know had a whole shopping bag with what he thought was hash. But it wasn't. It was, he'd gotten ripped off. So they wouldn't have been able to nail him with it, but he thought it was the hash.
How much did he get ripped off for?
A couple $100.
Really? That much? Bought from the wrong people.
He had, if all of what he'd had been hash, he'd have been a rich man when he got back to the States.
If you were planning on bringing it back. Okay, well, when you were, did you ever go into port in Vietnam?
No, not in Vietnam itself.
So you never really came in contact with Vietnamese citizens?
No.
Okay. Well, let's go back to Japan. What about prostitution? Was it very prevalent?
Oh, heavens, yes. It's the accepted thing. It's there. That's what you do when you're off duty. Let's go down and, unless you're married, and even if you're married, if you're in a port where your wife isn't, you're out and around and about. It's just, it's so widespread, it just hardly needs comment. If you've been in the Navy and you've been overseas, it's there. You go off the ship, you go downtown, you sit in the bar and you have a drink, and prostitutes are everywhere.
What about venereal disease?
Pretty bad. I couldn't give you any statistics or figures, but our corpsman aboard the ship, we didn't have a doctor, but we did have a corpsman, and they run tests on guys all the time and had penicillin and things to administer. And before you went back to the States, everybody ran through a checkup at the base clinic there and would get treated.
How many people made it back to the States?
If you got, a lot of guys would get, they'd keep you aboard the ship if they found out that you had a venereal disease. So a lot of guys, I suppose, were a little bit reluctant to report it, but I don't think so. I think most guys knew the dangers, and I just couldn't give you any figures as to how many.
No, figures aren't important, just opinion is good enough. When you were back on board ship, how did you feel about being separated from the opposite sex? Was it just something that you took for granted?
It's just something you lived with. Horny as hell, but there was nothing you could do about it. You would go out, you'd be out at sea for 30, 40 days, and fortunately or unfortunately, when we were out at sea, most people, and certainly all the officers, were so busy. Sounds funny, you really didn't have that much time to think about it. You'd be working 18 hours a day, and when you weren't working, pretty much you were either eating or sleeping. That would be the pace for 30 to 40 days. Then when you got back, sure, you were really ready to let go. And a lot of pent-up frustrations to be expressed.
Yeah, imagine. Did you ever feel that you were in danger of your life on board ship? Getting sunk?
When we were down in Vietnam, there was no problem. They didn't have anything to shoot back with us down south. They couldn't have touched us. And chasing the carrier in nobody could come after us there. And
so you never
had
really
an Air Force
felt
there.
In danger.
The only time I did wasn't in Vietnam. I'm probably giving out classified information.
Go ahead.
Up off North Korea, they run reconnaissance flights in all the time. And they have a reconnaissance plane that runs in. And
into North Korea?
Above North Korea, yeah. You patrol just outside the 12-mile limit, very close to, as a matter of fact, we got in the 12-mile limit once, scared the hell out of me.
Another ship did that, didn't they?
Yeah, and they got nabbed. Yeah. What you do is there's one missile ship up there and one old type destroyer that works with the missile ship. And the missile ship has all these controls, and they monitor. You both monitor the flight of the reconnaissance plane in, and he has a couple of guys that go with him to help him out, fighter types. And you monitor it in there, and if he gets in trouble, then you're there, you know, so that when he comes back out, you can shoot down whatever's after him or pick him up if need be. And I know we were running station on one of the ships there, and the guy that you run is, what you do is the destroyer that's behind the missile ship just runs a, they cut out an arc on the map, and they say that you got to maintain station within that arc so many miles from the other ship. And so if the other ship goes too close to shore, then your station keeping thing can be stuck inside the 12-mile limit. Shouldn't happen, but it did happen to us once, I know, I remember. And the only time I was ever afraid up there was, we have a very sophisticated electronics countermeasures system aboard the ship that came out of the fact that when the Israelis got sunk, or it was right off Israeli side, they shot a couple of missiles down the tube of some destroyers, some American destroyers over there. And so they quick developed a new ECM system and put it on board the ship.
What's ECM?
Electronic countermeasures. Electronic things that screw up missiles so they can't hit your ship. And they're on there, but they were so new and so sophisticated, they didn't want any of the enemy to be able to pick up anything from your equipment. So you always had it turned off. You're supposed to have it in passive, but everybody always told us to keep it turned off. And so one time when we were up there, what they come in, if they're going to shoot a missile at you, they've got these little fast boats that are just little boats, 40 feet long, that have missiles on the back of them. And they run out about 40 or 50 knots and shoot their missile, and then they'll go back in. And one time when we were up there, we got a report of a high-speed contact about 40 knots coming at us right away, and we were up off North Korea. And I thought they were coming at us for sure, and I knew the gear was off because that was my responsibility. And I was really working hard to get somebody down here to turn that stuff on. But it turned out either they turned back, or it was a bad radar fix or something like that, because nobody was actually there. Or if they were, it was just a bluff or whatever. Just for a couple seconds there, though, I was a little bit on the panicky side. And we played around with a Russian destroyer up there for a while, too, that was a little bit touchy. Nothing exciting, really. I mean, they were trying to interfere with our operations.
So it was more in North Korea that you were having...
It was the only thing I was worried about, yeah. Now, down south, if you'd been shooting up north, you'd have been worried about being shot back at. And if you were on an airplane, you know, off a carrier, the guys were flying, and they were taking it all the time. And those pilots had just, you know, lost a lot of friends. But our situation was fine. All we had to do was anchor and shoot.
So you never lost anybody? Or
yeah.
Just
never came close.
Safe. That's good. How long were you over there for? 1969, when did you get out?
Well, I got out in 71, July of 71.
And you were over there the whole
time? No, I was over there until August or September of 70. And then I went back to Japan again in April through June of 71. But during that period, I didn't ever go down to Vietnam again. So I was only on a ship that was operating in that area for about a year, and we were only down, we spent two tours of about a month shooting, and then we spent two or three tours chasing carriers. 5 or 6 months total down off Vietnam.
Did you ever feel that you should just tell them that you didn't want to be there at all?
Well, the last time we were down shooting, I was running the computer that runs one of the guns down at the bottom of the ship, and it bothered me so badly there. I was really sick. I was so upset mentally and so exhausted physically, and I just...
Because you were...
Because of what we were doing, yeah. Because I had my... Well, they'd send us reports back. You know, you shot up 11 trenches and hit 12 emplacements and this. And occasionally you get something back saying one kill or something like that, you know. And so it really got home to me that I was turning to the guy and saying fire, and the gun would go, and then they'd say, well, somebody died. And I was having a hard time accepting that, because all of my ideas had really, really started to crystallize while I was aboard the ship, working 18 hours a day, surrounded by people who accepted what was going on, more or less. Now, some of my friends were pretty liberal, but you know, I didn't know what I was reacting to. I was having a hard time keeping perspective and finding out what was going on. But the last time we left the line, I was sure I wasn't going to go back again. I didn't know if I was staying in the Navy or not, but I knew I wasn't going down to Vietnam again. Fortunately, we didn't get sent back there again.
If you had been sent back, what would you have done to obeyed orders?
I just had to tell the captain of my ship he might as well let me off, because I wasn't going to do it. And if he wouldn't, then I just would have stopped and sat there. And then, for sure, I'd have been court-martialed. No question about it. Because you can't object selectively to wars. You're going to object, you have to object to all war in principle. And I hadn't gotten around, I didn't know where I was. You know, it's difficult to formulate ideas when you're in a pressure situation.
Do you believe that you object to all wars now?
Now I do, yeah.
Complete CO.
Yes.
They'd never reactivate you, would they? Well, who did you consider to be your worst enemy?
Aboard the ship, you mean?
Anywhere. You know, was it the Vietnamese or the communists or the Americans or your commanding officer or what?
No. Or
did you even think about it?
Not exactly in those terms, but I wasn't antagonistic to the Vietnamese. We had some South Vietnamese aboard observing the ship. We lived aboard for a while too. I did get to talk to them occasionally. But and it wasn't my fellow Americans, because I was just like them. You know, I'd been there not that long ago. It was just the unthinking reliance on violence, I guess. I mean, there was no specific individual, just the red Otto Nixon.
Did you vote
Johnson
in
those boys? Let's see. Yeah, I must have 68.
Who did you vote for?
Humphrey.
Did you consider yourself to be a Democrat or a Republican or an independent?
Independent.
So it was more for the man than for the party?
Well, I wasn't red hot on Humphrey either. I didn't like Nixon. I guess it was more for the man. Mm-hmm. Though I wasn't 100% on Humphrey.
How did you feel about the moratoriums that were going on back in the United States?
I came to have a great deal of sympathy for them. When I was, the more we talked about it among the junior officers, the more I became convinced that it was ridiculous what we were doing and why we were over there. And I wished I was back there in Washington so I could have done some picketing myself.
What kind of news reports were you getting of them?
The Stars and Stripes, the Navy newspaper, which isn't as bad as you might think. It's bad, I'll admit it, and it's slanted. But I don't think it's any worse than the San Diego Morning Paper.
Well, what kind of reports were you getting?
Numbers of people and who was demonstrating where and stuff like that. what was happening on campuses. And, general news that was coming through, and you'd get broadcasts of specific things that would come in to our communications people, who could put out news on things.
Did any of your crew members or just anyone that you knew, did they participate in their own moratoriums overseas, in a sense?
The only enlisted that I had direct contact with were very right-wing, very militant warrior types.
We were interrupted by a librarian. We have relocated in the library and we'll continue our discussion from here. I can't even remember where we were.
You were asking about enlisted feelings about the war.
The moratoriums.
And my comment was that all of the men that I was associated with were pro-war. I can't think of any that expressed any anti-war sentiments. And some of the junior officers were, I suppose it was rather in our ship to be somewhat anti-war. But and I didn't have that broad a contact with the rest of the men on the ship to really know how they were feeling. I suspect, of course, there must have been some sentiment against it, but
there were no outward signs.
Nothing that I could see.
Nobody sitting down and saying, "I refuse to do this."
No, nothing like that. There were a couple of kids that tried to get out as conscientious objectors, but they were isolated incidents. So just. And no one that was objecting specifically to Vietnam.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that you can think of that would be pertinent to someone trying to study how American soldiers felt in Vietnam?
They would try to psych us up somewhat for being down in the middle of the gun line. Occasionally a helicopter would come and land some people aboard who would talk to us a little bit about the situation ashore, and the people ashore would always call back to us and say, you're being a great help and we need your support and thanks for shooting and that sort of thing. I mean, there was a definite line of propaganda that was put out for the ship, mostly from the shore establishment. Behind, other than that, just you're in the military, you're there to do the job, and mostly you did it. I didn't get that close with the enlisted people to know who was feeling what about it. I say our officer group was reasonably anti-war, but not to the point where it stopped anyone while we were there, at any rate.
Did any of the junior officers try to get out like you did?
No, not like I did. Most of them felt that... Well, when we came back, when we left the line for the last time and sat down and thought about things and talked it over with some guys, there were a couple of very, very staunch militarists aboard. There were three other guys that I talked with, of the junior officers, who said that they wouldn't go back to Vietnam anymore, and that they'd have to take what consequences came from that. But they couldn't reject the principle of the military, so they couldn't become conscientious objectors.
Mm-hmm.
And they all stayed in. They're all out, or they all get out when their term expired.
Yeah.
But
have you kept in contact with any of the people that you knew on board ship? Had to flip over the tape now for our second interruption. Let me ask you, I think we cut off on the other side, but near of importance. How did your father feel about you getting out of the service the way you did?
Well, when I first wrote to him and told him what was happening, he was a bit upset. He wrote me back that he thought I should think things over very carefully and that he didn't agree, and he listed some of his reasoning on it. But he didn't push it very hard. My mother had a stronger reaction just because she thought I was going to get in trouble and want me in trouble. But I was able to go home. Well, I was taping some. I sent my folks a tape recorder, and I taped some little cassettes and sent them back to explain what I was thinking about. And I think that convinced them that I was sincere and really knew what I was doing. And I took leave when I got back to the States and went home for 3 weeks, well, for 2 weeks, and talked it over there. And my father was quite remarkable. He was in the Navy for 30 years, and yet he took it very well. And as a matter of fact, he couldn't argue with me, basically, at the end. He did say that he had been in a submarine off Japan that dropped the bombs, and he said that when he heard about that, he was really worried about it. He said he could recall having some serious misgivings, but he'd already put 15 years of his life into what he was doing, and the war was ended, and he said he just pushed it in the back of his mind and didn't allow himself to think about it. And when I brought it up again, he started to think about it some more, and he said that given today's environment and the things that have happened and the way things have developed, that he doesn't know that he might have done the same thing I did in my position. He was liberalized, though. After he got out of the Navy, he taught high school for 10 years. Well, this is his 10th year. He'd been teaching for about 5 or 6 years then. And the association with the kids and had done a lot of good.
What was he teaching?
Man, high school man. He was also, he's very active. He was student council representative. And he ran clubs and stuff like that. He really got into the whole high school scene.
That's far out.
And it helped him a lot and broadened him a great deal. So he was able to take it. And as I said, my mother never really had any serious feelings on the thing one way or another. She just didn't want me to get in trouble.
That was her main concern. Did you think that having gotten that kind of that association, do you think that that hurts your job opportunities or anything like that, if they look at your service record?
You don't see it really well on the service record. It just says honorable discharge, and then it gives some codes and stuff, and I think there's conscientious objection on there somewhere. But most people just look for honorable discharge, and I didn't find any troubles. I looked around for a job when I came back, and I thought I might have some troubles. And when I went to job interviews, it came up, how did you get out of the Navy and all, and you went to Annapolis, but only for 2 years, and so the people could piece it together, and I wasn't hiding anything from people. I told them, and I really didn't think that it hurt me.
Did you have a hard time becoming reassociated with civilian life?
Oh, heavens, yes. It wasn't reassociated. Well, I guess reassociation. It was really a major break for me, and I had a lot of trouble. I didn't know. I had put all of my efforts and concentration into getting out of the Navy, and then when I was out of the Navy, here I am, I'm out of the Navy. I didn't really know where I was going.
Where did you go?
I took what money I had, took a couple months off and went camping, went up to the Northwest and around Montana and did some backpacking and stuff.
By yourself?
No, I had a girl with me. And then I came back and didn't know what I was doing still. And looked around for a job, didn't find much. Jobs here and jobs there. I just wanted some peace, put my head together, and finally picked up a job as a sub-professional engineering, some surveying, a few problem solving, little things like that, filing, property management.
And then you went back to school.
Then I decided to get back to school.
What made you go to state?
I was in San Diego. It was cheap.
Are your parents here in San Diego?
No, my parents are back in Northern Virginia. I was in San Diego when I went over there. I have two sisters who are married here, and I left a bunch of my stuff here. So when I got out of the Navy, and the girl that I took a trip with was here, I came down here She met me in San Francisco, as a matter of fact, and came down to San Diego, and I stayed at her place for a while.
You were associated with her before you went overseas?
Well, mostly when I'd come back, between my two trips to Japan. I'd met her before that, but I really hadn't gotten into it. But we got fairly heavy. And so I ended up back at school. I needed some knowledge, I thought, to figure out how things fit together.
Non-service knowledge.
And I had a reaction. I was very math science, maybe, oriented, and when I'm much more humanities right now, being a history major. I just changed my emphasis somewhat.
Okay. That covers it pretty well. I really appreciate having taken the time to do that. It's a pretty good tape, even with all the interruptions. It's the end.